So, John, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. We're here at Creatures, Crimes, and Creativity, one of my favorite regional conferences.
It's a great conference.
It's fantastic. And for those of you who don't know, John Gilstrap is the author of 30-plus novels,
yes,
thrillers, including, I believe, last time I checked, it was like 17 New York Times bestsellers. Does that sound about right?
Oh, who counts? Yes. Somewhere in that, yes.
If I had 17 New York Times bestsellers, I would be counting, for sure. Yeah, no, that's just phenomenal. So a huge success, very talented author. You also, since we're here at a conference, you also, you do some teaching, right? You speak at conferences.
I do. I didn't do any workshops here, per se, but I've been on a couple of panels. But I have to say, the big news here is that 6 Minutes to Freedom, which is the only nonfiction book I've done, is actually, it looks like it's going to be a feature film for Netflix in 2027.
That is phenomenal. Congratulations.
Thank you. That's the big news.
So, I mean, a Netflix show, that is a huge readership.
Yeah,
right?
Well, you know, you almost hesitate to say it out loud because it only takes one thing to go wrong to derail the whole thing. But for right now, I'm dancing on the news. So
like when you get, I mean, that's phenomenal. So congratulations.
Thanks.
When you get news like that, though, I mean, I know, I understand, like, especially with movies and, like, you know, there's so many things that have been greenlit and then stop in the middle of production, whatever. But don't you also have to celebrate these victories? I mean, that's even if it doesn't happen, it's so exciting.
This is the 8th movie project I've been involved with, and none of them have, well, 7 of them have not made it to the screen. But this one has made it farther than any of the others, and it just feels right. But yeah, you do. It's always a fun moment, but is that like anything in the entertainment business? You realize that it's all very fragile. But yes, it feels great.
I mean, because there's so much rejection, so many highs and lows, right? Reimagining careers,
right.
We all kind of go through these roller coasters. So when you have that moment, at least, I mean, what do you do to celebrate when like a new book comes out or you get a movie deal like this?
Well, there's a tradition in the family. When I got my first. The first movie deal, the first big deal that I got was Nathan's Run in 1996, and we had cheese crackers and champagne. Actually, then it was cold duck. It's all we had in the house. So that's actually what we have now is we do cheese and crackers and champagne. It's always been the tradition.
So as a writer, really successful, really talented writer, how hard is it like going when you don't have the control that you have with a novel, when you're sending something to Hollywood and there's so many extraneous factors and things that you have no control over and it can die at any moment? How psychologically hard is that?
Well, you do it long enough and you realize that a movie is a movie, and I have adapted other people's work to film, and you realize that a movie is an entirely different thing. So I divorce myself from it. I want them, because this is nonfiction, 6 Minutes to Freedom is a real story. So I want them to show respect and be respectful to the original work and to what actually happened. I've read the script and they do that. They leave a lot of stuff out, of course, because you have to. It's a feature film. But what they've got, I like. And there's still a lot, and with any luck, it sells a lot of books as a result, where you get to hear the rest of the story. But you have to pull yourself away and realize that, celebrate the win and realize that you've handed it off to other people to make a different form of art out of the source material.
So tell us a little bit about it.
6 Minutes to Freedom involves Kurt Muse was an American expat in Panama in 1989. Well, he grew up there, but in 1988 and 89, when Manuel Noriega was doing really bad things, he and his Rotarian buddies, Rotary Club, ran an illicit radio network to get him thrown out of office. And nobody knew who was doing it. I mean, the State Department wasn't involved, CIA wasn't involved. These were guys who were using like Radio Shack equipment to overrun the national radio.
It's crazy, right?
It is crazy. So like drive time radio, they would just pop in and say, Manuel Noriega is a really bad guy. So he became public enemy number one, and ultimately he was arrested and put into Modelo prison, which is a terrible place. And in the opening moments of Operation Just Cause, there's Operation Acid Gambit, which was a Delta Force operation to rescue him. And you know, after he was arrested, his family had to flee, including his children had to flee on their own. And so the rescue operation was just tremendous. The helicopter was shot down twice, and it was really, it's quite an operation, all the planning that went into it. So that's what the story is about, is a tremendous success certainly for Delta Force. If you recall back then in 1989, they were still coming off the horrible failure of Desert One and you know, came out of that. And Grenada didn't go all that well. It wasn't a horrible tragedy for them, but it didn't go all that well. So this was just a huge success for the U.S. and for Delta Force. And it's a great American story.
No, I love it, but it seems so improbable. Like, if you were writing this as fiction, I can see your editor looking at you going, so, okay, a bunch of guys with Radio Shack material putting on their own radio. Like, it seems so far-fetched, right?
Well, and a spoiler alert, in real life, when Kurt was brought home to Northern Virginia, his family was secreted off to Burke, Virginia. It was one of the few, it was December 20th was the date of the rescue, and it was one of the few white Christmases in Northern Virginia. And that's when he arrived home to his family, was on this bucolic white Christmas. I mean,
so your editor saying it's too much, John.
Exactly,
it's too on the nose. Can you make this a little grittier?
It's a great story, and I'm very proud of it and the people I met through it. And actually, it's the research that I did to do 6 Minutes to Freedom that made the Jonathan Graves stories possible.
Wow.
Because those are the folks I met and that allowed the Jonathan Graves series, who's a former Delta operator, that allows me to bring the verisimilitude to what he does.
So how did you first hear about the story, and what was your entry point into that world? Because you're talking Delta, it's a very secretive force, right? They wouldn't even admit they existed for many years.
Right. It was through Kurt did a speech at a Rotary Club, because that's the vector for all of this. And a buddy of mine, who is a Rotarian, said, you really not need to talk to this guy. And, you know, as an author, when you write stories, say, hey, I got this story you need to write. And, I'm good. But he started to tell it. So I met Kurt, and I didn't believe it was real, because it was so pat, and I did some research. And, you know, ultimately, the way the story played out to get access to Delta, I got Kurt's, we agreed to work with each other, and I got Kurt's story, and I got his extended family story, because this whole thing affected them as well, including his parents and his sister and brother, and none of them knew that he was doing this, and they all had to flee, like, right by God now.
Wow.
And what I couldn't get was the government side. You know, Delta wouldn't talk to me. So that started this research thing that I talked to a senator, and then I talked ultimately to Brent Scowcroft, bought him coffee that he didn't drink. It was weird. And then I got a call from President Bush's secretary, 41, and he was out of office at that point, and said, the president would like to speak to you. Can you be in his office next Wednesday?
It's not a call you get every day.
Right. I said, well, I got a dental appointment. Can you do it on Thursday? So I went down to Houston, and we talked to President Bush for supposed to be 20 minutes. Turned out to be about an hour and a half. And, not a lot happened. It was a great meeting. And then we went home, and about 4 or 5 days later, General Boykin, Jerry Boykin, who was Colonel Boykin in 1989, reached out and he said, I don't know what you did, but the guys can talk to you. So we got access.
So, I mean, it's so ingrained in these soldiers, right, that they don't talk about this. Everything's the highest levels of classification. How do you get them to really open up to you to get what you need as a writer?
They were cleared to do it. They were cleared to talk to us. Now, at this point, we're like 2001, 2002, and this was a 1989 operation. And I was very upfront to tell me what you... There were lines we couldn't cross, and there are lines I don't want to cross.
Right.
You know, I don't want to reveal secrets, but I wanted to talk about the training that they did and how they build up to it. And they're really cooperative. I mean, at first they didn't even want to tell me what weapon systems they used to go in. But then you get into the personal stories. It was 23 guys on this operation, and you know how it is. It's the realization when everything is going hot, and it's the personal funny, for lack of a better term, right? That's where the drama is.
Right.
You know, once they came in off, they blew the top off of prison, the cupola, and they went down the stairs. And things just don't go right. You train and you train and you train, and then it's this, when stuff comes apart, and it's how you adapt to what goes wrong. That's where the real drama is, and these guys keep going, and it culminates in this moment where, you know, Kurt had been in his prison. He thought it was the rest of his life, and the whole world is coming apart. You've got AC-130s that are hammering the Comandancia, which is just across the street. It's just huge war is going on, and here's this guy shows up at his cell door, blows off the door. They come in, they cover Kurt, and he hears, they called him Moose because he's a big guy. He said, Moose, we're here to take you home. I mean, think about that.
Oh, it's giving me chills, you know, right?
Yeah. This is here to take
he,
you home.
He knows he's going to die in jail, right? Yeah. He'll get executed.
Yeah. And so it's just a tremendous story.
When you were interviewing these guys, I guess what I was getting at before was, like, because they're trained not to talk about this, mm-hmm. is how they live their life. It's just, you know, they right. don't talk about anything. Did that at some point, did they feel like it was cathartic for them? Like, were people enjoying opening up finally because they had presidential approval to do so?
I think it was a trust thing. Mm-hmm. If Kurt were not in the room with me while they were talking, I'm not sure they would have talked. And I think it's important to note that to this day, the rescue happened on December 20th. And to this day, on December 20th, Kurt reaches out to them to thank them. Wherever they are in the world.
How great is
and,
that?
Yeah, and I think most, by now I think they're all retired, but when the book came out, a lot of them are still operational. The secretary that would reach out, they would be found, and he would reach out, you know, every December 20th just to thank them for his life. So that goes a long way to getting,
oh my God,
to getting
yeah.
people to talk to.
No, of course. Because, you know, I worked a lot with the IC, and mm-hmm. when you work in these sectors, when you have a success, a lot of times you don't talk about it because mm-hmm. talking about it can hurt the success, right? So when they're actually able to have something that goes into the public, I mean, I think there's a lot of benefit for it for the military to show these successes, right? It's a recruitment tool, but it's also an attaboy for people who mm-hmm. who really worked hard. So when you, as a writer, when you're writing nonfiction like this, are you using all the tools you use in, like, your Grave series, or are you
Well, I learned that I'm not a journalist, so I'm very, very patient, because I learned that I should have had a more complete list of questions a lot of times. So I would have to go back and ask more questions and more questions, and they were very, very patient. But when it was all done, you know, it was. I did have to give. There was no official approval required for the manuscript. I of course did. I sent a courtesy copy so that I don't want to get sideways with anybody.
Sure.
And I also don't want to accidentally give something away. I don't think I was exposed to that level of stuff, but the last thing I want to do is get anybody in trouble. But there is one level of detail that I thought was very funny. That there's a during the rescue, as they come down the stairs and they go down the hallway, Kurt's hallway. There's one particular guy that's assigned to shoot Kurt. And the shooter, his name is James Nelson in the book. That's one of the guys who was active, so his name was changed. He told me that he saw the bad guy was hiding behind a door, and he could see him behind the crack of the door. And he told me he shot and he hit the door jamb, and he shifted his aim, and then he shot through the crack, and he hit the guy. That's what I wrote. And it was his commanding officer at the time. He wrote back, and he said, John, you know, it's love the book. I know you can't tell the world that James missed on his first shot. So I changed it to he fired twice and hit. It's factual, but just changed a little
and,
bit.
And real, though, right? Yeah, like there was a RAND study back in 2008, I believe, that did all the NYPD shootings up until that point, and they found their hit rate was like 18%.
Wow.
You know? And now, a police officer in a municipal department is not the same level as Delta and the training that they constantly do and whatever, but still, real world, it's just different. You know, your heart's pumping, mm-hmm. your adrenaline's going, your sights are bobbing up and down. Mm-hmm. You know, shooting through a crack in a door is not an easy shot.
Right. And it was also really important that it was very important to them that I talk about the PDF people, Panamanian Defense Force, the PDF folks that they didn't shoot, the ones that just laid down and got zip tied.
Yeah.
And so that's in there too. That was very important to them.
They're mission driven, right? Mm-hmm. So their goal
their
is
mission
get this
was
guy
to get
out.
Kurt out. That was it. That was it.
they're not, they don't want to play. They don't want to stay there and do more than they have
this
to.
Is a very uncomfortable place to be.
So when you're hemmed in by reality, right, mm-hmm. so the facts, how much does that impact the natural storyteller in you when you're doing these, this is narrative nonfiction, but you're still telling a thriller?
I learned that you can do a lot with structure by changing, because I had Kurt's family in, they're trying to get the attention of the government, and I've got, you know, all these different things. So it was a long, it's a 9-month story.
Wow.
That is occupied by, you know, 9 months in jail. There ain't not a lot interesting that's going on there. So I found that by shifting the interesting parts of the story around, you could keep the pacing going. But what's really interesting here is that when Kurt's daughter, Kimberly, wrote a letter to the president, President Bush, that, you know, my daddy is a hero. The kinds of things you would expect a 15-year-old daughter to write about her dad. And she was concerned that the government wasn't paying enough attention to him. And it's a very articulate letter. And then she also wrote to Barbara Bush and said, I know your husband's a busy man, so in case he doesn't, that was the letter wow. that the president read.
Wow.
And then he it became part of the president's daily briefing.
Wow. That
so it's just so human.
Oh, the human drama, yeah. right? And the fact that, everyone who has a family, maybe they weren't on Delta Force, but right. they understand what it's like to have a family member they think might get killed.
Right.
And so much of that from the kids. But 9 months is a big time to draw out a thriller, mm-hmm. right? Like, so yeah. Do you think all these 30 plus books you have, you know, the best-selling thrillers in fiction, was able to help you, like, truncate? And do you have that, like, internal pacing in your head so you know when you just have to keep
moving?
Well,
I think that helps. It certainly helped in this case, but in... there was a doctor, James Ruffer, who would, because of the canal treaty, there was some stuff that was going on, he would visit Kurt because, you know, he's a doctor. But he would meet in the tunnel, as they would call it, with the Delta operators. They would give him an assignment. So he would count the number of steps as he was going from here to here. So he was bringing intel
yeah.
back on what they were doing. So there's a lot of drama in that as well. So there are a lot of moving parts that I could capitalize in order to bring drama to the story.
And how does, like, publishing nonfiction like this, like, is you as a writer? Like, I mean, obviously you're shining a light on this amazing American mm-hmm. operation. How does it feel different than, like, when you have one of your other, you know, bestsellers gets out there and gets a lot of accolades?
Well, I'll never do it again. It's really hard work.
Yeah.
In this case, bringing honor to this group that had both in Panama, those co-conspirators who at that point, they're just now coming out, as it were. They're just now stepping out and out of the shadows and allowing themselves to be known. I have nothing to do with that. But to show the patriotism that was going on there, as well as the stuff that was going on within the American government to help Kurt, as well as the military operations, as well as just the courage of his family, to be able to document that was really an honor. It's probably the most important book I've done. I mean, I think all of my books bring entertainment, and I'm very proud of that. But this is the book that made a difference, and I'm proud. You know, more people watch a movie than read any book, right?
Right.
So, and I've read the script, and the script takes a very small part of the story. But if that inspires people to read more of the book, that would be great. But it's the most important book that I've written.
Wow, that's exciting.
It came out
exciting.
In 2006, and it's available. You can't. I don't think you can buy a paper copy. You can buy them. You can use books, but certainly on. Still on
that's
Kindle,
an amazing
ebook.
Story. I can't even. I hope it does get made. I hope cross the finish line.
I hope so
one.
Too. I hope so too. That'll be. It's a tremendous story to see.
I can see those being very successful too.
Yeah.
You know, a lot.
And Netflix is exactly the right place for it.
Mm-hmm. So let me switch gears.
Okay.
We're going to wrap up here, but we're at a conference. Mm-hmm. What is it at this level of your career are you getting from the conference, and what is it you're giving back? Because, I mean, you're an incredibly generous author and you're working with other authors. And I mean, I really appreciate that, by the way. It's really kind of you. The little nuggets of wisdom you give people can change your career trajectory, you know? So what is it you're doing here, and what do you get from it?
Well, I think you give me too much credit about changing people's careers, but I've been doing this for 30 years. A lot of it's seeing old buddies. I hang out with you yeah. and Reed Coleman yeah. and, you know, folks that you just don't see very often. But in terms of passing on nuggets of information, I think it's just that. We had a panel on setting today, you know, settings and secrets, yeah. Which, you know, setting, plot, setting, and character are supposedly the three elements of a story. I just have a different take on it than I think it helps to let struggling writers, and we have a number of those here, not struggling, people, aspiring writers. Nice. And I think letting folks see a non-academic approach from a very practical and reasonably successful author kind of helps them see things. And just to be available and open. I mean, we've got an editor from Grove here that's willing to talk about, you know, that side of the business. And it's a good conference. This is a very nice conference. C3 is a good conference.
What's interesting is when you're talking about a slightly different take on something, mm-hmm. just hearing the same concept sometimes, but with different words to describe it, will mm-hmm. resonate with a different writer.
Right.
Like, I've seen that so many times. People, because, you know, there's so many concepts, right? And all of the hundreds of craft, thousands of craft books that have been written, but it's sometimes people just don't get it until they hear it in a different way. So when you're talking, because, I mean, 30 plus books, all these bestsellers, how much, when people see that level of success, because it's a grind, right? For it's hard, writing's hard and everything, but actually breaking out and getting a book that becomes widely read is so difficult. How much do you think that helps authors just to see someone who's actually done it? Like, and meet them in person. Like, here's a real flesh and blood human being who's doing what I'm doing, and they've actually been read.
I don't know. You know, I hope it's inspiring to see somebody who has just stuck through the grind. You know, it's not... Sales numbers, there's nothing an author can do to affect their own sales. There's unicorn hair and marketing teams and all of it. There are a lot of way better authors than I who have sold far fewer books. And there's no explaining that. I don't know how, I don't know if I inspire people or not. That's certainly not my intent to be here. I want to help people. And nobody in the entertainment business, maybe nobody in any business, but certainly not in the entertainment business, finds success on their own. My mentor was Stephen Hunter way back in the day. When those are the days of, you know, mailing in whole 300-page manuscripts.
It's changed a little,
it has. It has changed. But he was patient with me, and Jeffrey Deaver was patient with me. They didn't know me from Adam, and I didn't know there was such a thing as a conference back then, so you had to really be intrusive. But it's that kind of a community, and so to be a part of it is an honor.
Well, you know, you might not know that you're inspiring people. I can tell you, I talked to a new writer here today, and I was just talking to him. I'm like, so you having fun, whatever? He goes, I am just so ready to go home and write.
That's
you know
great.
What I mean? Just being here around this energy. And I think that, if nothing else, we've got that going, right?
Get people spun up to go and put words on the page. Yeah, that's great.
So where should viewers go to find your work?
Pretty much anywhere. Wherever books are sold.
I love it. And your website is what?
JohnGilstrap.com. That's the place to start everything.
Okay, fantastic. Well, John, thank you so much.
You bet.
A pleasure to see you here.
All right.
Congratulations.
Thank
well
you very
done.
Much.
Thank you.